Pieces come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times. Somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
As we record today's episode, prairie grouse hunting for sharptails, prairie chickens, sage grouse is only a few days away in states like Nebraska and Montana. And as we release this episode in early September, a whole bunch of other states are on the cusp of their prairie grouse seasons. So you guessed it, today's conversation, I've got three prairie grouse junkies. Do you like that, Carp? Are you a junkie?
I am a junkie. Yeah.
We've got three prairie grouse hunting junkies to share some tips, tricks, and a little bit about the forecast for prairie grouse. You've heard him. He's a national treasure. We've got Pheasants Forever editor Tom Carpenter, prairie grouse junkie. Welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here again on one of my favorite of all topics.
It is a beloved bird.
Birds.
Birds, yes. I was thinking very specifically, you love Sharpies.
I do, and we can get into that. But yeah, sharptails are, I often fashion them God's birds, and I love
them. I think
them.
You wrote that in the primer, didn't
it
you?
It is, yeah. You can see what I feel about sharptails. Read the Prairie Grouse Primer intro.
Yeah, and we are going with primer, not primer.
Yep, a primer is, actually, today is sort of a primer. Because we're talking, primer is teaching. It's a book. It's lessons, and we're going to talk about that. But the forecast is a primer. Gets you ready. Mm. It's a primer. So we're doing a primer and a primer today.
There's primers in your shotgun shells too.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
And then the second voice you hear. Working his way towards national treasure distinction.
I've got a name. You ready?
I'm ready for it. You're going to coin a name for Sparks?
I didn't coin national treasure. I sort of, you call me it. It's fine.
Somebody else sent that in.
Yes.
Maybe it was Tori McCormick?
It was a listener. It was a listener. Well, we can say Ryan's a regional gem. You like that?
Hey, I'll take whatever.
Okay, there you go. The regional gem.
Ryan, the regional gem.
So we have Ryan Sparks, the regional gem, and Quail Forever editor, and a prairie grouse junkie. Welcome.
Yeah, I'd throw myself in that club.
And rounding out our conversation, making his On the Wing podcast inaugural debut, Clyde Vetter. Thanks for joining.
Absolutely. It's an honor to be here with you guys, for sure.
Are you a regional gem, a national treasure, or a prairie grouse junkie?
I'm just a junkie.
So folks probably recognize your last name. Why don't you
tell them? I'm sure they do.
Tell us a little bit about Clyde Vetter.
Well, Clyde Vetter grew up in the central part of North Dakota. And I grew up in between three waterfowl productions. So I started out as a duck and goose hunter, and my brother took me out many mornings duck and goose hunting, and then I just started, and I had water spaniels and labs, and ended up really growing to love the Hungarian hunt, partridge, and then grouse. And there's just, once I got into that, there was just no going back. I'm just a junkie at heart when it comes to that stuff.
And I always catch myself when somebody from the plains says grouse.
Mm-hmm.
They're referring to sharpies,
yep.
Maybe chickens.
Yep.
When somebody from the Great Lakes, Minnesota, says grouse, they automatically are thinking rough.
Well, and it always throws me off, too. And in Wisconsin, I still have some clients that call them partridge. I'm like, partridge are out running around in the prairie.
And my grandpa would always say he'd say we're going pat hunting.
Yeah.
Or partridge hunting, which he meant rough grouse. Carp, you had some relatives that called them pats, right?
Pats, partridge, and my grandmother called them ruffled grouse.
Ruffled, yep. I've heard that one too.
Yep. Yep.
A bag of ruffles.
But what you're referring to when you say grouse in Central
Sharptail. So that's all we really had there was sharptail. And then, you know, I got into the dog training business, and that's been my career and made a good career of it. And obviously, Marilyn had you know, she had never hunted before either. And then I got her into the hunting, and man, we really fell in love with the prairie birds. And, you know, we had quite a few pheasant around there, but not a lot. And then boy, you know, in the 90s, it just really grew. So we did a ton of pheasant hunting as well. And then the Huns have been really diving there in the central part of the state, and they're finally starting to come back. So it's nice to see. And if I get a covey of five or six, I still have a real hard time shooting one of them. I let them grow, and you know, hopefully they'll come back. We've seen quite a few more in the last couple of years now, so they're really making a comeback. But yeah, we've been going down to Pierre in Montana now for quite a few years. And, you know, even like we're just big chickens fans too. And we're starting to shoot way more chickens now in the grasslands than we are even sharptail. So it's made quite a switch there as well.
I love that about Fort Pierre, the combo platter. But particularly, I mean, how many places can you hunt greater prairie chickens that are left?
Yeah.
You know, Kansas, South Dakota. There aren't too many other places.
No, there's not.
What do you attribute it to that you're seeing more chickens now?
Well, I wish I was a biologist and somebody could, you know, I'd have that answer. But there's a lot of answers I'm looking for. In fact, I gave some of them up to Scott Linden here a couple of weeks ago as well. But I don't know what it is. Why we're, you know, we've been hunting there for, gosh dang near 20 years now, and we'd mostly shoot all sharptail, and it just seems like every year it got to be a little more and a little more chickens. And last year, I'll be honest, I actually shot more chickens last year than I did sharptail. Mm.
Can you taste the difference?
No.
Can you, Carp?
No.
Sparks?
No.
I think I can. I think that prairie chickens tend to be a purpler in color, and I for sure can taste the difference between a young sharpie like a pinkish white color, and then an older sharpie that are darker red.
Yeah.
And I treat them differently when I cook them, so maybe it's in my head, but I feel like I can tell the difference.
No, I could see where there'd be a strength of flavor difference. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We generally, you know, we got a group of 15 to 20 of us that we camp out in the parking lot at night, and we cook birds every night. We make poppers with them, and I mean, eating them fresh every night, just it's fantastic. I mean, there's just no beating that.
I like the light colored young ones, and when if they happen to not get eaten in the parking lot and frozen, they have, my wife's name is Julie, and I write Julie on it because they're just primo.
Yeah.
And they're not as strongly flavored, and I like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
well, the difference between, you know, an old buck and a young buck.
Yeah,
Because if you're looking for some of the best wild game, and you could find those young of the year sharpies, it's about as good a flavor as there, because you're right, the older birds, the darker meat, can get a little sharp. I like it, but can get a little sharp. But those young ones, that is good stuff.
It's the older they get, it's more and more of an acquired taste, but fast and hot.
Fast and, the thing is this, you got to eat them like almost rare. I mean, that's just how they're the best. If you overcook them, it's no good.
Bob and I know that. It's because it's like woodcock.
Yeah. True. It is a lot like woodcock.
Yeah.
Clyde, you mentioned Marilyn, your wife, our boss, president, CEO of the organization. How has your life changed in the last year?
Well, I'm slowing down myself. You know, I'm...
From your work perspective.
Yeah, a lot of...
Sharpshooters kennels is what you're...
Yeah, I ran a... I burnt the candle at both ends for many, many years, as Marilyn did when she was an executive in the pharmaceutical world, but... This has been just a fabulous thing for us. You know, we always believed in conservation and many other things in the bird dog world, and this has really just been a fantastic route for us. It's been super enjoyable. You know, she was always gone from Monday all the way through late Thursday night, and then she'd work hard on the weekends, where now, at least if there's events and things like that, I can tag along and... It really just works really good with my venue, and it just ties everything together. And it's just, I've met just a lot of wonderful people. In fact, Ryan and I, we got to spend some time together down at the Prina Nutritional Seminar thing. And, you know, you and I, we get to go to shoot the clays together. Mm-hmm. So met just a lot of wonderful people. And you guys coming down hunting with us in Arizona and stuff, it's just, it's been fantastic. And you know, we've been able to tie some of my clients' lives together and with Pheasants Forever and stuff as well, you know, with a couple of our clients. That's been working out really well. So it's been fantastic.
You mentioned that you and Sparks were here recently in St. Louis mm-hmm. with our friends at Purina. Mm-hmm. Well, we won't go dive deep, but what's one thing, I'll ask both of you, one thing that sticks out from that trip with Purina? Anything that you learned or caught your attention?
I'll let him answer that first. Then,
yeah, broad strokes, I would just say the amount of science and quality control that goes into a product that a lot of people just think of as dog food, mm-hmm. and they might think it's pretty even across the board. But the amount of thought and research and stuff that goes into their kibble, and what would they tell us? They do like 100,000 quality checks an mm-hmm. hour or something like yeah. that. I mean, it's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I've had the pleasure of being down there many times, and that's why I wanted to have him mm-hmm. answer it. But they're just a fantastic company that actually, the thing I love about Purina is they do so much testing and quality control. I mean, they know within 4 hours where if somebody had a problem or noticed something with the bag, within 4 hours, they can tell you where that came from. But yeah, their quality control, their science behind everything. They have, I think, like, what, 500 scientists there. I mean, they just fabulous job. I mean, what the work that they put into the dog food is amazing. And then, you know, then they rely on people like all of us to give them feedback as to how it's performing. And I don't think there's anything out there that compares to it, honestly.
Yeah. So I went on that trip 4 years ago, and I had that same reflection. My goodness, the amount of science that they mm-hmm. put into this, the number of veterinarians and researchers mm-hmm. that are on staff. So you layer that in dog food that's top notch, right, from a science perspective. And then Ducks Unlimited, their support of Ducks Unlimited, Rough Grouse Society, you know, Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, they give back
yeah.
so strongly to conservation. It's like yep. I see some of these trolling debates on social media mm-hmm. over dog food, like, you know, I know there's good brands out there, but nobody can touch Purina from their support yep. of conservation.
No, absolutely. Yeah, they're couple of veterinarians. I mean, I worked with Dr. Arlie Reynolds a fair amount and on some different things, and then Dr. Ruth Ann that they have there now, and Dr. Sarah Love. I mean, they're just fantastic people. Yeah. I mean, fantastic. But yeah, they're, and that's my thing, is so many people have, again, looked at other dog foods and stuff, but what have those other dog foods done for the dog organizations, you know, all the different competitions out there, or testing, and then also conservation? I don't think anybody steps up to the plate like Purina does. Not even close.
Well, that wasn't intended to be a advertisement, but this one is. Onyx is a proud supporter of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. Onyx gives back to our habitat mission and the wild places we all love to hunt through our access programs. You, the listener, and right now is an absolutely terrific time. Go to the show notes and use the code PFQF at the link there, and you'll get 20% off your Onyx subscription, your Onyx membership, and a portion of your purchase will go back to Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's wildlife habitat mission. Thank you to Onyx. All right, we will go. So we're going to do a kind of a multi-parter here. We're going to start with the Prairie Grouse Primer, the forecast, and then we'll get into a little game after that I like to call Prairie Grouse Battleship. So just whet the listener's curiosity with that one. all right. So Tom Carpenter, editor of the Pheasants Forever Journal, you served as the editor for the Prairie Grouse Primer, brought to you or sponsored by Sportsman's Guide. You can find it on our websites in detail at Pheasants Forever or quailforever.org/primer. Carp, we'll start with you. You covered the states from Minnesota to Idaho. What, or at least coordinated content. What's the overview of the northern part of the Prairie Grouse Range for the forecast?
Yeah, Ryan served as our more Southern Plains guy. He's going to talk about Nebraska and Kansas. You know, by design, we're going to keep this simple, but it's going to be a good prairie grouse year. You know, a lot of us have concerns about, all the rain and mm-hmm. hurting the pheasants. And, you know, this isn't the pheasant forecast, but that rain doesn't affect sharp tails as much. And I think there's a couple reasons. One is they're high country birds. Mm-hmm. and two, they're native. And we all love pheasants, but they're a little different. And it seems from the reports I got across Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Idaho, and into Minnesota, which I did myself, that the rains didn't hurt production as much as we are worried about pheasants. And the winter was mild, so that was the first thing. Mm-hmm. Birds made it through the winter good. You know, there's often talk about rough grouse. Oh, they do better with deeper snow, and mm-hmm. science proves that. And to some extent, prairie grouse will snow roost, but they do better in an open winter. And they had a fairly open winter and certainly not any extensive bad spells of weather. So that was good. I think the consistent news was the hatch seemed good. Mm-hmm. People are seeing birds that I was talking to. And it's going to be just prairie grouse hunting. You're going to go out. You're going to put on some miles. You might go an hour and a half, 2 hours, 3 hours, a whole morning, nothing. The afternoon, boom, you find them. That's prairie grouse hunting. So I'm going to leave it at that for the northern plains. There's birds there, you know, Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, the parts of Idaho with birds, southeastern, which I've hunted a lot. It's going to be a good season. You just got to hunt.
I'll clarify a couple things there that you said just to make sure our listeners are picking up what you're putting down. You mentioned prairie grouse are highland birds, or what was the term you used?
High country
birds. And what you're referencing there is pheasants tend to nest in a little bit lower areas, or they can nest in little lower areas. So those rains that came in early to mid-June had the tendency more so with pheasant nests in low areas versus prairie grouse that are nesting in higher ground. So those pheasant nests with heavy rains can get gully washed their nests yep. out. And if their nests get blown out, then the pheasant has to re-nest
yep.
and the number of eggs decreases. Same thing that would happen with sharptails and chickens, but on the higher ground, less susceptible to being gully washed out.
Yep.
The timing between sharpies, chickens, pheasants, very similar. Mm-hmm. Like they initiate nests at the same time. Their peak of the hatch is similar. So timing-wise, it's very similar, but it's a little bit about nest selection that creates better scenario for prairie grouse in a really wet year.
Yep. And I'm glad you mentioned really wet year. Here's another reason I think it's going to be a good year is a lot of us know that grazed ground is the best, but the right kind of grazed ground. And even in this
you're
year.
You're giving away one of your tips here.
I'm like, don't
maybe,
say it. Don't
maybe
say
one
it.
Of my tips. Good. I just knocked off a point for you guys. Can we? Okay, I can't count this. We'll get into the strategies on prairie grouse battleship. But a lot of rain is good for regrowth. And mm-hmm. I'll leave it at that because I'm getting into stuff. So
all right.
I think it's going to be a good year, Northern Plains.
All right. Southern Great Plains. Ryan Sparks took care of Nebraska, Kansas in particular. What does Southern Great Plains look like?
Yeah, so the rain, from what I've heard, has been great for Kansas and Nebraska. Those are two states that were in really bad droughts. Nebraska, particularly a couple years ago, they had one of the lowest recorded harvests of any year. I mean, almost all-time lows. But since then, you know, there's been a bounce back with the rain, the habitat's looking good. The nesting and brooding conditions were great this year in both states from all the people that I talked to. But you know, it takes birds to make birds as well. So even if those birds did well, they can only produce so many. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the biologists I talked to said, it's like an investment. You can only get back so much from your initial, you know, investment to get back that return. Mm-hmm. So hopeful is maybe mm-hmm. the word I would use. Things are on the upswing from everyone I talked to. And like Carp mentioned, you know, this is just a preview of our primer.
Yeah.
And we hire a whole team of journalists and they talk to multiple sources yeah. to do these reports. So really, if you want to know more, definitely go look at the report and read, read what we've put together, because you're going to learn a lot more there than we can talk about today.
Mm-hmm. Quailforever.org/primer. One other note here as it relates to the biology of sharp-tails chickens. You know, exactly like pheasants, they're only going to do one nest attempt. One nest success. So like pheasants that lay down a clutch of eggs, if the eggs get washed out, the sharp-tails will re-nest. If the chicks hatch and the chicks get predated, they're done. The minute one egg hatches, they're done. So when people say, well, they pulled off a second nest this year, second clutch, that doesn't, they may re-nest a second time, but there's no such thing with sharp-tails, chickens, pheasants doing a second clutch of birds. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to your point about you got to have birds to make birds, you know, a lot of times there's mythology around, oh, well, it was such a good nesting season that sharp-tails had multiple clutches of birds. No, yeah, that's biologically not the case.
You're not going to go from 1 to 100.
It's right? A little less clear with quail, because quail have the potential, particularly what I term the Mr. Mom advantage with quail, where the males can incubate and females can lay multiple clutches. But with sharp-tails, chickens, pheasants, it's one and done for a clutch. Mm-hmm. So you need birds to make birds, and it's going to take a little time. All right, anything else you want to touch on from the primer, the forecast aspect of it?
No, go give it a look. It's a good read. If you read and look and think a little bit, you'll figure some stuff out. Also, I'd say think about Montana. We go by region. Anybody's ever been to Montana, you know, it's different and it's big, and it's broken down regionally, and that's valuable too.
Yeah. All right. Before we get into Prairie Grouse Battleship, I've got one more advertisement, but this is a really this is a new one, and it's really fun. Premium moments in the field are brought to you by Green Belt Premium and Premium Light, the pheasant friendly beer. New as of September 15th, Pheasants Forever camo cases will be available in stores across Minnesota and the five states surrounding Minnesota. Pheasants Forever logo will be on Grain Belt Premium. Good land, good beer. And today's premium moment comes to us from Matt Weber's in Aberdeen, South Dakota via Facebook. Matt fell in love as a youngster with his grandpa's lab, and his girlfriend committed to buying a puppy before he knew it. Doc was his first dog, and Doc is a lab. So Matthew and Doc got used to hunting his grandpa's private land and finding a tremendous amount of success. But one Saturday, Matt decided in mid-December that he and Doc were going to set out on public land in South Dakota. And this is his story. We started out on a small parcel that I know is good for at least one rooster. And sure enough, Doc finds one and only one. I do my part, and we're off and running on our challenge. We move on to another tract that covers two quarters. I've rarely ever hunted it, and I'm going in blind with a sense of adventure. I could tell Doc was too, and he set out and immediately made a beeline for the edge of the cattails. We quickly covered 100 yards of a giant slough, and Doc flushed the second rooster, and down it came. We started off again, and bam, another 100 yards traveled, and out pops the third rooster of the day. He lets out a cackle just as my shot catches up to him. Doc goes running and brings back the bird to my hand. Only an hour and a half into public land South Dakota challenge, Doc and I were done for the day. That was my Green Belt Premium moment. This is Doc's third season we're coming up on, and we both can't wait. So there you go, folks. The first ever Green Belt Premium moment from Matt Weber's in Aberdeen, South Dakota. Matt, thank you very much for sending that in through Facebook. A prize pack from Green Belt Premium is headed your way. So we will be reading, or I'll be reading Greenbelt Premium Moments from the Field over the course of the next few months. So we'll be asking for you to submit them through Instagram, X/Twitter, Facebook. I've got a whole bunch of them lined up already for the month of September. You want to email me, you can email me at bobs@pheasantsforever.org and I'll interject them. You got something to say, Carl?
Am I eligible?
You are not eligible.
Dang.
But I know where you can find some pheasant-friendly beer.
I need some of those.
I got to imagine that was your college beer of choice.
Greenbelt?
Yeah.
Yeah, Greenbelt and Point.
Stevens Point. Mm-hmm. There we go.
I feel like we need to put in a soundbite of a beer opening? after you read the story.
Yeah, you need to do that for your next one. That's a great story.
Yeah, I thought that was fun. So I've got in the next few episodes, we got the Rough Grouse Society folks coming up, and I have a Rough Grouse Premium Moment coming up, and there's another pheasant one. There's a quail one for our photography episode coming up. So
I like it.
So thank you all to everybody that submitted Greenbelt Premium Moments. If you got others, you can email me at bobs@pheasantsforever.org. All right. Here is the part you've all been waiting for.
And as we're all looking at each other and trying to figure out what their strategy is going to be.
I would talk about the game, and then Carp is just dying to tell us his strategy. We'll start there. So Prairie Grouse Battleship. We're going to go around the horn five times, much in the same way we did with our favorite Upland book selection. But to add a little fun into the mix, I'm going to award a point to the first person who delivers a prairie grouse hunting tip into the conversation first. So if you introduce a tip first, you get a point. And Clyde, you're going to get to go first, you're automatic.
If I recall, did Tom not say in our email thing that I get a point to just start with because I'm the newbie?
You essentially earn a point for going first because nobody else.
You got it.
You're going to get point number one. We know where our bread is buttered.
When you brought this up, it's like, what do you mean I got to give away a bunch of tips?
Well, if you want to lose, you can throw people off the trail.
Yeah, that's my strategy, is just to give really terrible tips because they're not tips that you guys would give.
So we all have to be honest, though, that that's not on my list. So it's five, right?
So we got four rounds. Okay. Four rounds. And then if Clyde, who's going to go first, says whatever it is, and it's on your list, you have to say, you sunk my prairie grouse battleship.
Okay. but there's four. Is there four or five?
I thought it was five.
Is it five? Okay.
Yep, it's five.
You said...
We could go...
There's a final thought. That's what it is.
Yeah,
is
final thought. I have four rounds.
Okay, four rounds.
With one final thought.
Okay.
And just so you know, this... You know, if winning or not doesn't affect your raise.
Is final thought one? Is final thought a point, though?
I love how much he wants to win.
Okay.
All right, tell us your strategy. How are you going to win this?
I don't know. I'm
not changing the rules. The rules have been in place for
over a
week.
Why is he pointing at me?
Clyde, because I can tell you thought about this, too. And you did, too. I mean, obviously, I don't have a corner on the winning on what is a winning strategy, but... There's some things everybody that there's some tips that everybody should know that I think we all know. And the point is, and the idea is, am I going to put that tip that all you guys might have on my list? Or am I going to avoid the so-called obvious to only go for the little more esoteric ones, the little more fine-tuned, the little more subtle ones?
Well, I know I have one on here that none of you guys do. You, Bob, you know of it.
I hope it's number one.
And you thought I was crazy. No, it's not number one, because I thought I have to say something that you guys have so I can
see.
You got
to save your ace in the hole for the end, because then they'll all be eaten up. So.
Yeah.
I feel like I should be paying you guys rent for the amount of space I have in your head right now.
I know, right?
This is really just intended to be very fun.
I mean, once you start, but I'd say, why save your best for the end? Just start, you know, use it and get a point. Do you want to play from behind or ahead?
Is it an offensive game or a defensive game?
Best defense is a good offense.
All right. So everybody understands the rules?
I believe so.
Okay.
Who's final judge and arbiter?
I am. Oh. I'm going last. So
yeah, you get that.
I've basically guaranteed myself a loss here.
He's a fair guy. I can vouch for Bob. He'll arbitrate this well.
You hope.
What's process for lodging a complaint?
I guess we'll have to engage Marilyn as a arbiter.
She's not here today. Can you get a hold of her on your phone?
She might not answer the call.
Right.
She knows we're doing this. All right. Let's start round one. Clyde kicks us off. Carp gets to go second. Sparks in the hole, and I back cleanup. All right. Clyde, what's prairie grouse hunting tip number one for our listeners?
Well, everybody's looking at me to see what it's going to be, but obviously coming from the dog trainer, I think most of you know what that's going to be, and that's going to be hunt with a well-trained dog. I mean, there's just, if you're running with a dog out there, hunting with a dog out there, that's going to be running, you know, 100 to 600 yards ahead of you, and they're taking out birds, and you never get a shot. We all know that's not good for putting birds in the bag and or enjoying the hunt. Mm-hmm. So hunting with a well-trained dog, and also I think I have to say here, and Bob, I know you're going to agree with me, that a German Shorthair pointer is the only way to go, right?
You're looking at me when you're like, make sure your dog's not out there past like 100 yards to the pointer.
No. My dogs, they'll take 400 or 500 yard casts many times. I love a good running dog, definitely.
But, especially on prairie grouse country.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. I mean, there's nothing like seeing them up on other hilltops, and then one's pointing up there and one's backing, mm-hmm. and you're kind of hoofing it up there, mm-hmm. and you're hoping the birds are going to hold. But yeah, well-trained dog. You know, we had a little conversation before that too about snakes, mm-hmm. and porcupines and mm-hmm. badgers. And I mean, I've ran across many badgers out there in the grasslands too. And you know, having, I think, a super steady dog, mm-hmm. that's not going to jump in on snakes and porcupines, and you can avoid a lot of that. I mean, knock on wood, I've been lucky so far, but I've had maybe a couple of small quills, but nothing that's a catastrophe at all. So mm-hmm. a super well-trained dog. And then just both conservation-wise, retrieving your game, mm-hmm. finding that down game, I think it's just it's a key factor in having a fantastic time out there is having a well-trained dog. And I'll take back my comment about the German Shorthair pointer, because I've hunted with a lot of great pointing dogs. Had the pleasure of hunting with Larry down there in Arizona last year with his dogs, and I'm just so sad because I got to shoot some birds over Oni, and I know he lost him just recently. But any kind of pointing dog out there in the grasslands, to me, as long as they're well-trained, is just so much fun.
Yeah, you kind of took away that how I ever end every episode, right? Always follow the dog. And that's really true.
Trust the dog. Yeah. And it, you know, really, so we talk about that I've had clients, you know, cause I'm known as a bird hog, just because they're like, how do you always end up with all the birds? How do you, and you know, it's just, I trust my dogs. Mm. And if they're taking a different route, you know, dogs start getting desperate when they're not finding game. They're going to start getting desperate. Hmm. And I let them get desperate, and I let them go looking for those birds, and I just follow them. Hmm. And it's panned out for me. I mean, there may be times where we got to reroute because we're coming across some land that's going to be private and we can't go that direction. So we'll just reroute. You know, the dogs start getting desperate if they're not finding birds, and they'll start stretching out there, and I let them. And that's when we start finding some birds.
I've never heard anybody use the word dogs get desperate. That's interesting. Have you heard that before, Sparky?
Yeah, I have.
That's cool.
Yeah, I can't count how many times you draw out this big plan of, we're going to go down this slough and then we'll hook in. And then the dog runs the complete opposite direction, goes on point or something. It's like, mm-hmm. well, I guess we're going that way.
Yeah.
Can I offer a little corollary? So, first of all, so nobody, no sunk battleships here, right?
I did not have that on there. Anybody?
Safe.
No? Okay. We're safe.
Safe.
All right. You earned a point.
Okay.
You earned a point.
All right.
I'd also add to Clyde's, you know, well-trained dog, sharp-tail country's different. They got to be used to it. But a lot of my tips are for the beginner, and getting going and really and getting people out there to experience this, because there's nothing else like it, is that flushing dogs can do the job too. Mm-hmm. And I see a lot of them do it. Cockers.
Absolutely.
And labs, mm-hmm. springers, they all can do it. It's a different game, but you can do it with those flushing dogs too. You know, I think one of the cautions I give, if you got a black lab, it's off an early season, you know, watch the heat and that, but
Flushers can
do it.
Don't say too much.
Don't.
It's not even your turn.
Yeah. Well, we'll stop there. Okay. I can see a wrinkle to this game, whereas if you sink somebody's battleship, you get a point for every battleship you sink too. But that wasn't the rules of this particular game, so I'll save that for the next
time. No, he's absolutely correct. You can. We have a good friend who's got both pointer dogs and labs, and you know, my dogs, if they see a lab sitting, you know, because they hopped, although I don't think his dogs hop and sit when they flush a bird. But, I mean, I've trained pointing dogs to point that backing dog if they hop and sit. But, yeah, I mean, you can definitely do it with, you know, English cockers are fantastic for that. Labs are good, you know.
The guy who taught me how to prairie grouse hunt, Rick Young, who was a coworker here, always had labs. And he was a stone-cold prairie grouse killer. Mm-hmm. I mean, he and his labs were poison. So you're right. They're flushing dogs. It's a style thing.
Yep.
What do you like more than the next?
Yep, for sure.
All right, Carp. I don't know if you've already thrown out a couple of your tips, but you can officially go with tip number one for you. Go ahead and earn your first point, Carp.
See your boots.
See your boots. Dang it, I think I know where this is going, and you maybe got me.
Sharptails are creatures of open country. They're of the prairie, especially when we're talking about the places we're talking about today. They're creatures of the open prairie. They want to see like a pronghorn, and they don't like thick grass. If you're a pheasant hunter, and I'm not going to talk about anything but the thickness of this grass, sharptails like to be able to see. They like to be able to run. And anybody who has hunted sharptails know they run, they move. And if you're in cover that you think, man, this looks good for pheasants, it's probably not sharptail cover. So if you're a pheasant hunter going out to hunt sharptails for the first time, don't go for the pheasant cover. Don't go for what you feel comfortable in. Go for something where you can see your boots, where those birds can run, and they can probably see you coming too. And I'll leave it at that. See your boots. Don't get too thick of grass.
So it's too bad we're not recording in the KFAN studios right now, because I would need a button bar. You sunk my prairie grouse battleship. Because I had...
Can I ask a question, though?
Yes. Yeah.
Do you find... And I've had this experience. Do you find that chickens tend to hang out in a little bit heavier cover at particular times of the day?
Yes.
Well, and that sharptails will tend towards that heavier cover later in the season. Yeah.
You guys are absolutely. Yeah. I believe that 100%.
Yep.
Chickens are not. Chickens could almost be construed as more open country birds than sharptails, but they will glom to brush. Mm-hmm. And I see it when on the occasional few years when I get to hunt in northwest Minnesota for chickens, they like the
brush. Well, maybe that's why I'm shooting more chickens, because I'm noticing these particular types of brush and cover within a field.
That could be.
Of light grass fields, and if I congregate to that, man, I'm just...
Yep. And
getting lucky.
Well, the way I articulated this, which I think sinks my battleship, which I think is a distinction here with an audience built around pheasant hunters and quail hunters, I wrote, if the grass reaches your kneecap, you're hunting too thick of grass. Because I do think in terms of pheasant hunters, if you're looking at grass and it's heavy for pheasants and it looks good, it is too tall. Because, I mean, we've seen plenty of sharptails in pastures that cows just left, right? Where it's you can see cow pies, but you can't see the chickens until your dog goes on point.
Don't get into cows too much.
Oh.
Okay, I was just going to say something. I won't.
So I'm going to – I have lost a point, So
yes,
that's the happiest you've been all day.
It really is. It's good. That's good.
All right, Sparks, you're up next. Earn your point.
Okay, so I have another beginner tip, but I think it's an important one. A lot of people's first experience encountering sharptails is in country that overlaps with pheasants, and they might not be on a sharptail hunting trip specifically. So there's a lot of pheasant hunters that encounter sharptails for the first time, and I've experienced this a lot with new folks coming out to my family has a ranch out in South Dakota, and we'll go out there and hunt, and new folks will come out, and that first group of grouse gets up and hen. They don't know what they look like. So even if that's just pulling up a photo, I think just a video of what they look like, their tail is shorter, it's more pointed. The way they fly is different. It's hard to describe. A lot of times they'll kind of beat their wings and then glide a little
bit. Five flaps and a glide.
Yep. And then that little bubbling cut, cut, cut. Yep. If you hear that, I mean, that's like hearing a, you don't have to look when a rooster pheasant gets up and crows. You know what it is. Yeah, it's the same.
Why
same
didn't
with
you
a
shoot?
Yep. So they miss a lot of pheasant hunters miss chances at sharp tails because of that. So.
Wow, you did lead with a very easy one.
Mm-hmm.
Proper identification.
Softball.
Point for Spark.
Well, he said he wasn't giving away his good tips.
Yeah. Well,
he's just taking ours in.
All right. My tip, number one, and Carp even baited me into this a couple days ago, and I'm still going to roll with it. Never, ever empty both barrels on the covey rise.
I knew you'd have that one, so I didn't put it on here because I trusted in you. That's a good one.
There is always a sleeper bird, especially early season.
Well, wait a second though, you're counting on you missing though. You should have a double. If a covey gets up, dude, you should have two on the ground. Come on.
This is why I hunt with three shots in a semi-auto.
I was going to say, does your gun have two barrels?
I get two shots, and I never shoot the third. I never shoot the third one. I save it.
I've seen you hit two birds in a covey down in Arizona.
Yeah.
I know you can do it.
I could do it. But
and then you reload quick, and you get the popcorn bird, and you're done.
Well, there is that, but normally that sleeper bird, relating back to the meat, that sleeper bird is the youngest, dumbest one, and boy, do they taste good, Clyde.
I like it.
Well, you got to have the well-trained dog, though, so they're not chasing all the birds around, and then it's gone anyways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yes, I missed my fair amount of one of those, too. So that third bird, that sleeper bird is always a layup. Especially if you're expecting.
You know, a little story. My dad, my dad never hunted. It was my brothers. And my dad, once I got him into pheasant hunting and everything, he used an automatic too, like Tom. But he would always put a 3-inch first and then a 2 3/4 and then put a 2 3/4 in on top. And that third one, he always planned on shooting all three, whether he was, you know, hitting any or not. But that third one, he always called the kicker. That's why he used the 3-inch, you know, to reach out there. So he planned on missing the first two, and then he had the 3-inch to kick it in there.
So I am picking, I mean, I know some of your tips, and that's dangerously close to one of the ones that you might have on your
list. It is.
You're also wearing one of your dangerously close tips.
I am.
All right, we'll get to that. All right, after round one. Clyde with one, Carp with one, Sparks with one, St. Pierre with one. We are in a four-way tie after round one. All right, here's what separates the youngsters from the veterans. Round two, Carp basically giving you another point here.
Well, maybe not, though. You're right.
You get to trot it out there, but it's got to be the second one on your list.
All right, lee side, third of the way down.
Okay. Explain what you mean.
Frequently, we're talking about this high rolling prairie land, and we all know it's an ocean, and oceans have waves, and you're walking these waves, and we often wonder, and the wind is often blowing often harder than we would like it to, but wind should never keep you away from any type. Well, there gets times in some hunting where like the wind's just too much, but with your when you're sharptail hunting, there's always some wind, and sometimes there's more. If it gets up much above 10 miles an hour, it becomes a factor. And what do these birds do? They don't like most game, they want to be where they can see, and they want to be where they can hear, and they can't hear if they're up on the top. Mm-hmm. And I've developed a theory, and it seems to have worked is I like to get off the ridge tops. Don't want to silhouette yourself. Mm-hmm. And get on the lee side, and about at the third down. They don't want to be down low. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be on top, and walk the contours off to the side on the lee side of a ridge, whether the wind's coming across into you. It doesn't really matter. That's why our dogs run around. That's why our dogs, if you ever look at your dog's nose, why he has a slit on the side of his nose. They can smell from different directions coming in. It's not just straight on. Let that guide. And I'm a little different than you guys. I hunt with a pointing dog, but for me, in prairie grouse country, letting her rip is letting her get out 100 yards. I hunt with my dog fairly close, variety of reasons. But where do you find birds? And this is a beginner tip too. Get off the ridge lines. Don't silhouette yourself. Stay on that lee side. Try and get where the wind is not blowing on, but it's blowing over the top. Hunt about a third down. They want to be up where they can fly off or where they can see something coming over the top. Mm. Lee side, third down.
And it sounded like that's sunk.
Sunk it.
Which, what number did you have that listed as?
Number two.
Number two. Oh, so you don't get it. You're not going to score on the second round.
Oh, I can't just default to another round?
No, because that's part of the game.
I'm keeping track of battleships with zeros. You can get your point, but you won't have a third. You can try and get your point, but you won't have a fourth one at the end.
Well, we can do it that way too. So sure. We can just move it up. But I lost my second one as well. So your second one was leeward.
That's okay. Right.
Clyde, did you have it?
No, that was a given. I knew I was going to put that one down. Good.
No, I know him already. He knew somebody was going to have that one, and so he kept it off his list.
All right.
Two of us had it?
Two of
50% of the room, yeah.
Yep. All right. So, Sparks, you can roll out your second one.
Does this one count?
This will count.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You lost one.
Okay. It's just going to be to scout, and I think there's multiple ways to do that. I will actually scout e-scout before I ever leave, especially if I'm going to a new area. The first thing I will do is the U.S. Drought Monitor, if you guys ever looked mm-hmm. at that online. I mean, you can break down the whole country by county and look and see what the drought conditions are like. So you might be looking, oh, we're going to go to this county in Kansas, and you pull up the drought map and quickly change your plans because it's a mm-hmm. giant purple square on there or something. So find an area that's not really drought stricken, and then I will compare that with Onyx and find public areas to go check out. And then once you're on the ground, I mean, I remember once in South Dakota, hunted all day, had a tough day. We were kind of drowned in our sorrows with a beer on the tailgate at the end of the day.
A Grain Belt Premium.
Sure.
Premium moment.
I do like Grain Belt. It might have been a Grain Belt. And we're sitting there, and we just have to be parked in a spot where you could look over this great big vista. And right about sundown, you could see those birds leave where they were loafing and feeding and flying to roosting areas. And you know where we went and hunted the next evening? Mm-hmm. Right where they got up from, and we had a fantastic hunt. Mm-hmm. So just sometimes it's worth getting there a day early and not just setting up camp and diving in. It's sit up and do a little scouting.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's so true. Of everybody thinks about that with big game, needing to scout, particularly whitetails, right? Pattern them. It's just as important for birds, but not everybody thinks about
it. It's as important. Yeah, I can't even tell you how many times I found birds by, and I won't get into that because it's part of my.
So did he sink your battleship?
Well, he may have wounded it a little bit, but he didn't sink
it. The bilge pump is running.
No, he mentioned a word, but.
Okay.
I don't know. Sunk it?
We'll debate it as it arises.
If you guys think he sunk it, fine. But
make a note, Bob.
I've got a note.
He hit it with a 50 cal. It it wasn't, no,
it's a battleship.
Yeah,
he got one pellet in.
Yeah,
sometimes it only takes one.
All right,
especially with prairie grouse.
I will move up into round two. I carp eliminated what I originally had here, so my suggestion is get yourself some trail running high tops or hiking tennis shoes, like Salomon, Salaway, Hoka's, instead of your heavy-duty traditional, you know, winter hunting boots. Because, I don't know, how many steps you think you put on, Clyde, to hunt Sharpies?
We put on anywhere from 14 to 18 miles easily.
Yeah.
And on a rough day, maybe.
Of your own walking.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Of my own walking.
One of the biologists I talked to said it's about miles per bird, not bird per mile.
So if you think about that, in just say 30,000 steps, and walking that in heavy duty hunting boots versus some trail running tennis shoes, and to your point, Carp, you want to be able to see your shoes.
Yep.
You know, you're not walking heavy cover. You're just trying to cover ground.
Yeah.
And the lightweight tennis shoes with, you know, and I high tops, you know, because you don't really know what you step in badger holes and stuff.
And good soles because it's often rocky and stuff.
Right, right. Yep. But you can save your energy level for day two by just wearing some lighter.
And dog training, I'm used to. I mean, the most steps I've ever put in was 42,000 in a day.
Wow.
But, you know, another good one, too, is the Zamberlins, the 1996 Vios GT rubber rand. They have like a 10%. They have got a curve on the back and in the front, so they relieve a lot of walking stress. I mean, they're just kind of roll on the prairies, and they're nice, too.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the Salewas, and there's many good ones.
Salewas, that's how you pronounce it?
Well, you know, we just got back from Italy a month ago, and we were actually in Bolzano. And in Bolzano is where Salewas are. And I used to always call it Salawa, too.
I call them Salaways.
Yeah, and Salewa. I was pronouncing it wrong. And actually, we had gotten a guide when we went up into the Dolomite Mountains. And he was a big Salewa fan, and he corrected me. And he's like, it's Salewa.
Huh, okay.
So, but yes, Maryland's got a couple pair of Salewas. And actually, my buddy just ordered a pair of Salewas for our mule deer hunt coming up. They're a really good brand. They're made right up there in the Dolomite Mountains where all the Crispies and the Kenny Treks and the, you know, Zamberlins and Loas and all those are made too.
Yeah, there's some great ones out there. Like even like elk hunters and stuff has started to go to like what almost looks like a tennis shoe, but they're really well made. And then if you need to, you can throw a gator on over the top of it.
Well, for years I was following rock climbers, and that's where I started wearing all these boots. And everybody, I've been wearing Zamberlin boots for years, and everybody's like, Zamberlin, what's a Zamberlin or what's a Salewa? Now you're starting to see these brands even at Scheels and a couple of these other sporting goods companies. They're starting to really make a forefront.
Cool. So, but nobody had it? Nobody? Well, looky. I got a number two point. All right.
So that was just about wearing the right boot.
It was.
Okay. Yeah, I don't have that. That's a given. That was a given too for me.
Wait, do you know what they look, do you know what the birds you're hunting look like?
All right, Clyde, your opportunity to earn point number two in round two.
All right. So this is where I'm going to just expound on the if you guys determine if I was
okay,
if
this
I
is
was
the
sunk
50 caliber shot on a battleship. Yeah.
So I'm a big fan of Onyx, and everybody knows that, or should I say everybody. The people that know me know that. I study Onyx, and I've got general and we're out hunting. I got a few people that are relying on me to get them into some birds, and I get clients all the time that want to learn how to sharptail hunt and chicken hunt and hunt the prairies. And so I'm showing them how to use all this stuff. But I study the topography on Onyx. So I study the topography. And then also, too, you can put the layer on there for the crops. And so I'll watch where the crops are, what the crops were the previous year, because they have to rotate them every year. So I look at what the crops were last year and then what's going to be in there this year. And so I study Onyx quite a bit that way. And then also, too, I look at Onyx because I mark everything on whenever I flush a bird or have a covey after that particular 2-3 hour walk, I'll go back and I'll mark everything as to what I found where. And I have different colors for different, you know, covey or a lot of birds. I use different colors and markers, and I put all my parking spots in there. And I have all these spots that I need to check out. So every year that I go on a hunt somewhere, if it's the same 20 by 20 square mile area, I always want to find 4 to 6 new spots to hunt. I'm not going to always go and hunt my same old spots because, as we know, the cattle grazing changes every year. And so we watch that. I don't want to, I'm looking at Tom because I don't want to give away his cattle thing, but, you know, I watch where the grazing has been and that'll change where I'm hunting. But no, I study onyx quite heavily and study where I've hunted in the past, what's there this year. And, you know, obviously the food sources and the grasshoppers and where the flowers are and all that is. So I pay attention to that because they'll generally hang somewhat close. When I say somewhat close for a sharp tail or chicken, that's a 2 mile range off of that food source.
I love that tip. I think
it sounds like one you would have on your list.
I think it's obvious. No,
it's a given. It's a given, right?
I didn't mean that in a bad way, but I think it's great. If you can rewind your podcast as you're listening, listen to that again. Mm. I'd add that Clyde said. I'd add one more thing, and I think, and this doesn't take away if anybody has this, but Bob knows this too. Is you can get down, you can ratchet down to the level of detail of shrubs and bush patches. Mm-hmm. And so I'll leave it at that. You can get to that as a scouting, you know, mm-hmm. to tie back to Ryan's. Yeah. That can be scouting too. If you're
You can't tell that based on onyx.
Oh yeah,
shrubs.
You can see
snow.
You can see snowberries on there
because they're labeled, or you can see
they're different
satellite image.
They're a different color.
Oh, okay. I can see that. Yeah. I see what you're referencing.
I have shot. I have found some of my best sharptail spots by onyx scouting. To go back to Ryan's, or by scouting, by doing it on X, like Clyde said, and seeing, oh my God, look at the snowberries here, look at the shrub patches. This must be plum along this bank.
Okay, I can see.
Yeah, and you can look at it and see, like, okay, I hunted in this spot in South Dakota in 2022, and you can see on X, it'll tell you when that satellite photo is from. So look at where. You can say, okay, so I hunted this, so I know exactly what this looks like from an on-the-ground perspective. Well, over here 2 miles to the north, there's a spot that, on the photo, it looks exactly like that spot hunting. And you can just do that as well. And the crop layer thing, like especially early season when the sunflowers are still in, like those grassy areas adjacent to sunflowers, it's kind of weird to be walking in a sunflower field that's up to your chest for sharptails, but they love those sunflower fields. Yeah.
In the show notes, folks, there's a link to Onyx, and you can use that link and go use the code PFQF and get 20% off. I think you're right that Ryan was talking about scouting pretty much visually. Mm-hmm. You were talking very specifically about Onyx as a tool, which I still am concerned that Carp normally would have that on his list. Because you've talked about in previous podcasts falling asleep with onyx as your nighttime reading.
I've been there many times.
I'm sure my onyx looks like Clyde's with different colors and different marks. Mm-hmm. And you know, whether it's water, shrubs, chicken, sharp tail, got a bird, missed a bird, saw birds, check out this area. I just think it's a given one, and it's a good one.
I've played that game with a couple of friends of mine that go out after we've gone out, and they're struggling, right? Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, send me a pin where you're at. You'll send me a pin. I'm like, oh, man, you're really cold right now. You're really cold. I don't even know what you're doing there. Mm-hmm. I said, try north a little ways. And so then he's like, well, we got into a few, but it wasn't that good, you know. And I'm like, well, send me a pin where you're at now. And I said, you're getting warmer. Yeah,
so so you're looking at the satellite images for the same thing.
Well, but when they send me a link to where they're at in Onyx, it pulls up in my Onyx, so I can tell exactly where they're at from where I've been in all my hotspots. Yeah, I shouldn't say my hotspots. They're everybody's hotspots if they know they're there.
But you've known you know where you, because you mark all your birds.
I do. I mark everything. When people see my Onyx map, everybody wants me to send my whole link file to them. They've offered to pay me money for it, but I don't give that up.
I heard we're going to auction that off at Pheasant Fest next
no,
year.
No, I don't think so.
I don't know. Marilyn said.
you can auction off her Onyx. She's relied on me to have it for all these years. She's finally downloaded it. Now I said, you need to start learning how to use this.
You're ready for a joke, and you can delete this.
Great.
Somebody once offered me $1 million for my wife for my Onyx points, and I said, I'm sure going to miss the old girl.
Hashtag national treasure. All right. Yeah. At the end of round two, Carp with two, Sparks with two, Clyde with two, St. Pierre with two. Unfortunately, Sparks and St. Pierre have lost one. So it is a unless we have a rally, Ryan, I think it's a two-dog race. But you can take the lead right now because you get to go first.
Oh, yeah, and I think I'm going to steal one of Clyde's, but I think he kind of levels mine up. So I'll tell him – I'll say the first part of mine, and then I think I picked up on what yours is from your garments here, which I think is a great tip. Didn't even think about it before. But it's just that sharptails are really – wary birds, and they live in open habitat, and they can see you and they can hear you coming from a long ways away. And my tip was more on the hearing, like don't be hollering at your dog, don't be talking to your buddy, like try to keep quiet, avoid talking and yelling if you can. And I think that helps a lot.
Well,
do you want to
dog,
pick it?
Well, yeah, no, so obviously, yeah, well-trained dog, you don't need to scream and holler at him, right? I try and hunt as silent as I can. And I know I love hunting with Marilyn. I, you know, if I have a buddy hunting with her or something, I'll put them off in a different direction. And first of all, what I always do is, like, I've hit birds over there on that hilltop, on that side hill, over here, there. And I'll say, you pick where you want to go, because I don't ever want to get blamed to be a bird hog, because I always am blamed for that. And I'm like, I just, you know, I follow my dogs, and I've learned where to hunt for these things, and you just need to learn it as well. And but, yeah, Meryl and I will split up some and spread out just enough to where we can be quiet and hunt, and for sure.
Hunt quiet. Silent. Or hunt quiet.
That doesn't sink mine.
It doesn't. Okay.
Well, I don't know. Does it?
I'm guessing it doesn't, based on...
Because he said...
No. Not if you're...
He said hearing.
Go ahead.
He did. He did. I was thinking he was going...
Am I next?
You're not.
Okay.
Because...
We should have sat in...
Because Carp has alluded to one as well. You know, not showing a silhouette. But we're getting there. So, Ryan, you are in the lead. Relish it.
Okay.
Because it's likely to go away.
Okay.
I'm gonna tie you for the lead now.
Okay.
But I'm gonna know that it's gonna go away. My tip, and I'm sure somebody's gonna say, "Well, that was obvious," is go to bed early, get up very early, and use the cool of the day and the dew on the grass in your favor. It's more important with Sharpies than anything else. Pretty obvious. Oh, no. Did I sink anybody's battleship?
No, it's a good one. If the weather's warm, you got to get out when the
dogs
can work.
I've won many a bets doing that.
Yeah,
I've won many a breakfast off of a good friend of mine, Mr. Norman. He always says he's going to beat me out there, and he's going to have more. He's going to have his limit before me, and I've sent him video of three birds in my hand by 8:30, and you know, early bird gets the worm.
The dew on the grass makes a huge difference, particularly in September with your dogs being able to scent. And then as the day warms up and things get more challenging, there's a lot of advantages to being out there early. All right, Clyde, you're up.
All right. So I don't hunt prairie grouse with orange on. The only time I'll have a little bit of orange on is my hat. And that's if I'm hunting with my wife or somebody else, so that when we're on that leeward side and you happen to crest it a little bit, at least your hat is showing off, you know. But I generally hunt in very drab clothes and, you know, maybe a slight camouflage top and just like a tan pant. But birds have very good eyesight and they see color very well. So I don't want to stick out with a white shirt or orange shirt. I want to mix into the background. And like Tom said, hunt the leeward side so you don't skyline yourself. But the, if the birds can see you coming and you're making a lot of noise, like Ryan said, you're not going to do well. So I try and use everything to my advantage. So I try and hunt in Maryland as well now. And I have buddies where they're struggling. I'm like, well, tell me what you have on, you know, and then tell me, we'll get into one of my other things later on too, why they might be struggling. But yeah, it's, I don't wear anything bright. I want to try and blend into that grass line as much as I
ghillie
can.
Ghillie suit.
So I wear
camo face paint.
You know, I'm a big fan of these sun shirts. So I've got a bunch of Kuyu sun shirts that are in that drab color, or like the camo that I have on right now. And I've got some Sitka lightweight ones that when it's hot out, I wear them. But then if I put a vest or something on too, it's all very drab or a camo that's going to match the grasslands.
You guys abide by that? Do you wear camo? Do you wear?
I don't wear camo. But 100%, I agree with that. That's a really good tip. Yeah, yeah. And I just, when I think, what do I wear? I wear, you know, a green or a brown or tan, and tan pants or gray pants. I'll put orange on my hat if I have somebody with me, just so we see each other, mostly for the heat of the moment. If I have somebody with me and I'm saying, you come in, here's a point, you come in, so we, you know, there's no doubt they can see us. But I think that that's a great tip.
Prairie grouse is very different than pheasant hunting, because in pheasant hunting, you're in cover that you can't even see Maryland. So a hat's very important, and maybe even a flag on or sometimes helps. But yeah, when you're prairie grouse hunting, like I said, if I'm with somebody and I know they're going to be within that 100 yards of me, which we generally are around that 100 yard range or apart from each other, just an orange hat at least, because if they're skylining, you know, on the third leeward side or something, they're definitely visible.
Yeah.
So one kind of note here is make sure you check your regulations for the state and what blaze orange laws are.
Absolutely.
Because every state is different. Same thing with, you know, my mention of hunting super early. Know what the opening hours are in your state, you know, because that can change.
Yep.
So with all these tips, check the regulations, because they are different in every state. You know, I've witnessed the drab color making a difference. And you think about it, I think about sharptail hunting in western Minnesota, where I kind of seen century birds where I haven't seen them in other places. And by century birds, I've seen one sharptail sit on a tree in a whole group that's on the ground, right? But one bird sitting on the tree is looking for predators. And, you know, that's where, whether we want to say skylining or the color, that century bird is, you know,
they're
looking,
for a reason.
They're looking for us.
They do the same thing on the plains. They just don't have a tree to do it in.
Yeah.
Yep.
There's a century there, believe me.
Yeah.
All right, Carp, you're up with round three's closing thought.
Bob knows I'm sort of a contrarian, so I'm going to give this tip. And it's temperature dependent, but sleep in.
Okay.
I went through my last 3 years, I could go through 32 of years worth of journals. I don't know if it's quite the mean or the median. Those are different, you know, average or the median. I seem to get more birds from 10 to noon than at any other time of day. And here's what I think. I think it comes back to the sentries, and it comes back to where they roost. I find that when I'm out there at the crack of dawn, and I'm thinking of the big country out in South Dakota, Montana, North Dakota, which is basically what we're talking about, where do birds like to roost? They roost up on top, unless there's a little wind where they'll be on the lee side, but not by much. But at dawn, they're up on top, and no matter how good you are, and we're in short grass, no matter what you're wearing or how stealthy you are, they're going to see you coming because they've got the advantage. Mm-hmm. How do you win a battle? You have the high ground. Yeah. And I think one, they can see you more, and they're not out at dawn. They have one thing to do, survive, but they feed out into the morning. I mean, we say 80 is hot, 85's hot, 70's getting hot for some dogs. Mm-hmm. It's not hot for prairie grouse. Right. They're just out there doing their thing. They're feeding by mid-morning, mm-hmm. and then you've got a chance where they're occupied. They're busy. They're not on top. They're maybe in some cover. They're maybe in the snow berries, and they also spread out. And that's where you'll sometimes get the covey, and there will be stragglers because they're spread out. Yeah. That's when you get the stragglers. You can also find a straggler and get it, and if you're careful, you know there's more mm-hmm. around. That bird is not alone, and then you concentric, you circle, you find them. So if it's not, believe me, if it's going to be hot, I'm out there, the butt cracking on.
So there's my question. Can we both be right?
Yes.
Yes,
100%, absolutely. 100%. And I'm of that ilk, too. If it's going to be hot, I'm out there hunting.
Especially early season September, you know it's going to be pushing, right?
If you want to hunt, you have to be out there. But if it's going to be a cloudy day, 70 or 60s and under, I'm like, screw it. You're gonna
have a couple extra Grain Belt premiums.
Yeah,
he's gonna get some coffee
exactly.
and pancakes.
Exactly. So I like that late morning if the conditions allow.
Yeah.
I think it's the time.
No, that's why I love this bird and prairie grouse hunting is. They're challenging and it's not a recipe hunt, yeah. You know, and it's there's a lot to figuring them out, the weather, the food sources. There's just so many things that you as the hunter have to adapt. You have to know the conditions and all these other little things, and you have to learn to adapt. And and that's where like the scouting and the what's going on right now. Mm-hmm. And there's so many things to it. And that's what I love about it.
I learn something new every year.
Mm-hmm.
I still do.
All right. The end of round three, Sparks with three, St. Pierre with three, Clyde with three, Carp with three. And now we go to the fourth round. And I am up first, and I no longer have any of my four left.
So, one down.
So I am officially eliminated. Clyde, for the lead, gets to go.
All right. Well, I am a rare bird on this one.
Mm.
And I think you know where I'm going with this.
Are we talking about ammunition?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought maybe.
So I've done a lot of, you know, I'm kind of a long range freak when it comes to competition shooting and all that. But also for like all my hunting loads and everything and all my shotguns, I test everything. I'm a freak when it comes to that. I love testing my loads. I love testing my choke tubes. I want to make sure I'm set up, right? So my favorite load, and I know people are going to hear this and they're going to completely flip out, but all my grid friends that hunt with me know I have a big advantage over them.
Well, you're a good shot. That's the first big advantage.
I use Federal turkey loads, and it's an old load that they had. See Tom's eyes? That's the look I get.
Say it again.
Federal turkey loads in a number 6, 3-inch, number 6, and 20-gauge, though. I don't shoot 12s. I'm a 20-gauge or 28-gauge guy, but Federal turkey loads. And I pull this out when they're very jumpy or later in the season. And so I've tied them in with the Carlson choke tubes in a mod and full have been my premier go-to. And I have lots of witnesses that I'll tell you that I bag my birds very early. But the thing I like about that is I've had so many clients that call me up and they're struggling, right? And the birds are too jumpy. We're not even getting any shots off. The dogs are holding point well, but the birds are just jumpy, and they're pointing them so far away, but we can't get to them. And I'm like, well, what are you shooting? And they're like, well, I've got Skeeton-improved cylinder in, or, you know, IC and mod. And I'm like, and well, what kind of shot are you using? You know, they're like shooting 7.5s or 8s or something. So for me, I can always, and it goes to shoot, you know, training dogs, I shoot thousands and thousands of rounds a year, right? So I'm fortunate that way to be a better shot, but I can wait and shoot a bird when it's 50, 60 yards out and kill it with my turkey load 6 and mod and full choke. Mm. But you, if you're shooting an IC, you're not going to do that with a 7.5 or even a 6 shot. You're not going to make that shot. You're not going to kill that bird. You may wound it, but you're not going to kill that bird. So that's where I've always, even if I get to get up in front of the dog and flush him, I can wait to shoot, which is perfectly fine with me, because then if I want to, Bob, I can pick them younger birds out and have better eating. So that's my thing, is that's treated me very well. Like I said, I'd rather wait and have a good shot than just throw a bunch of lead in the air and wound birds. So
the turkey loads, are they lead? Are they tungsten? Are they steel, bismuth?
So I'm switching. So that's what I'm doing right now, is I'm switching. I bought everything. When they were getting rid of them, I bought everything that they had, and they were lead at the time. And with everything that's going on right now, I'm switching over to steel. So I'm testing actually right now. I've got a bunch of different chokes that I'm going to test. Excuse me. And I'm going to test some steel shot in something very similar.
Wow.
And doing a ton of reloading like I do for all my long range competition stuff. I'm if I need to, I'll reload something. But as of right now, I think I can make something work.
So, Mr. Turkey Hunter himself, what's your reaction to Clyde's surge into the lead with point number 4?
I like it. I think, as I said about the birds, I learned something, if not every trip, every year, every you know, not maybe not every day, but every trip and every year, I learn more. And I just learned something about that. So I think it's a great tip. I mean, it's a great insight to be able to shoot them farther out. It makes a lot of sense.
Well, that load is an ounce and 5/16 where you can't find that. I mean, so ask Marilyn about it. She can't shoot them because they pack a punch. Pack a punch, but they reach out there, boy.
So what about this, Clyde? My you know, initial thought is, you know, a lot of, like, I'm pretty consistent on 7.5s, you know, and I'm not as good a shot as you. I can't get them at 50, 60 yards. I'm just not going to do it. So, but a lot of times, like, tell a story. Last year, Lark had a point, and my friend was watching me, and it took me 5 minutes to get that sucker to fly.
Huh.
I didn't know where it was. It was a leftover bird,
and
I kept going and going and going. It's like, I'd throw up my hands, and I just kept kicking, and I was looking on the ground. Where is it? And the dog would not move, and it went out, like, point blank.
Huh.
And, you know, with my improved cylinder 7.5, just boom, got it. But what would you do in that situation? Let it get out 40, 50? Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, obviously we all know what I'm going to do at a bird if I take it up close, but I generally, you know, with training dogs and stuff, I'm so used to, you know, cause when we're doing a lot of testing and I'm training dogs for people, if I shot everything close when I'm training dogs, those dogs don't learn to make long retrieves. They don't learn to stretch out. If they can't find it close, they don't learn to just go deeper, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always, in fact, the laughing thing is with all my friends that always come out and are people that dog train with me, I'm always wait. Okay, shoot. and then they miss, right? Because they don't have the right ammo and the chokes and stuff in. But I love long retrieves for birds or for dogs. I think it teaches them so much. Mm-hmm. And obviously when you're wild bird hunting, you're going to have some long retrieves because you may nip it and it may glide or a little bit, but I like long retrieves in dog training. So I'm so used to saying, wait. And I know those guys are all laughing right now because that's always the joke. But, like I said, I'd rather be able to take a shot and wait. I can always wait, but you can't say slow down so I can shoot you, you know? Mm-hmm. So I like that in my back pocket.
Mm. All right, Carp, for the tie in the fourth round.
My last one is go later or go back. So my tip here is, you know, for many of us, you know, maybe we get a dove hunt in. Sharptails are the first thing on the docket every fall. And I know so many people that go the first weekend, and maybe the second weekend, and then they're sort of done. They're getting into other stuff. And I think, at least from my experience, it's an old wives' tale. that you can't get sharptails in October or November or December or prairie chickens for that matter. It's the biggest wives' tale it's ever told. And you will not run into another hunter when you go back, when you go later or go back. So I guess the tip is, if you can't get out opening weekend or the second, life gets busy on all of us, go in October. The birds are still there. You can still get them. And Clyde's nodding that October, November, who cares? They're still out there. You can get them. And I did it a couple years ago. I took a trip to North Dakota for pheasants, and I left a couple days on the end, and I went to Sharptail Ground and did just fine on October 31st on Halloween. And they're out there. You can get them. If you love them and you like to hunt them, why only do it two weekends a year?
Yeah, no, and your food source will change dramatically when you go back in those time frames.
Yeah.
But we've had, Meryl and I have had some fantastic hunts that first week in November. Mm. We're watching the weather, and I'm always checking the areas that we go, and I'm like, gosh, Marilyn, it's going to be like highs of 50, 55 and sunny for like 4 or 5 days out there and not much wind. We really need to go. Yes. You know, and that's just it. You watch the weather. Now, if it's going to be windy and cold, I'm probably going to hold off. But if I see it's going to be sunny and 50, 55 and not much wind, man, I'm hitting the road, because that's when I've had some of my best hunts. And Tom is absolutely right. There's not a soul around, because what are they doing?
Pheasant hunting.
Or getting ready to go quail hunting.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. After four rounds and a grand total of, let's see, 8, 12, 14 tips, two were doubled. So
not bad.
Not bad at all. Lots of good tips for the listeners. We'll end it here with a tie. Like kissing your sister, as they say. Clyde and Carp.
They are shaking hands.
The Prairie Grouse. Yeah, we should have that as
well. So we go from junkies now to gurus.
Yes. Yes.
Sorry, Ryan. You're still just a
junkie.
I'm
just the regional, whatever regional Carp called me. Local yokel, I think, is a polite way of saying that.
Well, thank you for playing the first ever game of Prairie Grouse Battleship. We will close out this episode with a final thought. All right, here's the final thought. You can go on a prairie grouse trip anywhere of your choosing, kind of the quintessential bucket list for prairie grouse. Clyde, you get to go first.
Alaska.
For prairie grouse?
Mm-hmm.
Ptarmigan?
No.
Sharptails in Alaska. Okay.
You need to start reading, Bob.
Yeah. Well. Now that you bring that up, I do. I am. Have you done it before?
I have not. I have several clients and friends up in Alaska, and I have a standing offer. And I have a.
Why haven't you done it? It's Alaska. It's a long ways to get.
No, it's not. You know, we've been up there twice now, and my clients and friends, they offer to come up or to have us come up there and take us ptarmigan hunting and stuff. I want to take my dogs.
So you haven't ptarmigan hunted either?
I have not. Not up there, nope. So that's the plan, is I plan on throwing the dogs in the truck and taking the highway road all the way up there and spending some time up there.
Hmm.
I've been in bush plains. I've landed in the areas where they go ptarmigan hunting. So Meryl and I had the opportunity. We were up there. They took us in the bush plane, one in each bush plane, and they took us up and flew us up where they run their dogs and exercise them and stuff in the summer. And Richard Ray, he and his buddy up there took us up there. He's a NAVDA judge as well. And we did a couple seminars up there. And it's amazing. That's how they exercise their dogs up there. Huh. That's how they hunt. It's crazy.
And what part of Alaska are the sharptails?
I'm not exactly sure. I'd have to go back and read that article again. But I know there's quite a good population up there. I ended up talking to one of the guys that was at the seminar that actually hunts them quite a bit up there. And then I found that article and read it. I'll get the article, because I have it saved. It's actually, I think I have it on my end table. I'll get it to you. It's really interesting.
Yeah, you can, well, you think about Alaska, ptarmigan, sharpies, sprucies, ruffs, sooties. Am I missing anything? I mean, Alaska, if you can get there.
Moose, doll sheep, well, caribou. Yeah.
You're on a different track.
Salmon.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful state.
Have you been there?
Yeah.
Have you bird hunted there?
No.
Carp?
Never been there. Never been. Yeah, have to make it happen.
Yeah. I would love to get up there.
I fished there.
Like you, Clyde, I would love to make it with my own dog.
Yeah. Road trip.
Yeah.
It sounds like, because they're hunting right now. As
we oh, you want to see all the pictures I've been getting sent to me? It, yeah, they've been rubbing it in.
Yeah, good grief.
Yeah, they've been hunting ptarmigan now for, I think, 2 weeks already. Yeah. And they can hunt them.
So they can late, too. Like
I've been
April.
To like the end of, well, I think it's the end of May. Yeah. In certain areas, small little pockets and stuff. But, yeah, they...
I should have moved to Alaska when I was like 16.
Yeah. Carp, you get second choice. Where are you going?
Well, I'm going to take a little different track. Not my dream. I looked back. I've hunted prairie grouse since 1988 in Idaho, Utah, Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Kansas, Nebraska, and Minnesota. You know, those are the, you know, Clyde mentioned Alaska. What a great idea. Canada would be cool.
Mm-hmm. You know, oh, for sure.
You know, especially you can get up there and hunt Huns. God, I love them. Yeah. So if you're thinking, I've got to go sharptail hunting, North Dakota is probably it. It's ground zero. But I'm going to make a suggestion to the listener if you're traveling to hunt sharptails. Go up to northwestern Minnesota and make a multi-species hunt. Mm. Now, the data shows, and you can read it in our reports, that South Dakota and North Dakota, which are sort of the meccas along with Montana, they shoot about, in both Dakotas each, they shoot about 60,000 sharptails a year, 60 to 70. Minnesota hovers between 10 and up to 20,000, and that's in one corner of the state. So 20,000 sharptails a year, it can be harvested in Minnesota if they had the hunters. But you can also hunt rough grouse, and you can also hunt woodcock up there because you're in that transition country.
And spruces.
And spruces,
yep. And if you apply for the permit and get lucky,
which is residents, but not the non
chickens.
But if you're going to make a trip up, think about northwestern Minnesota and make it a long one and hunt rough grouse, hunt woodcock, and hunt sharptails, probably within 50 miles of one another, maybe more. You might have to do a little traveling and make a little circuit, but it could be a great adventure for a hunter who might not be from this country, from the Northern Plains, from Minnesota and the Dakotas and Montana, and or even, you know, consider a Minnesota multi-species trip that sharptails are a part of, because there are sharptails and there can be a good number of them in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And there's hundreds of thousands of acres of public up there too. You might almost be focusing more on the ruffs and woodcock, but you can get out there and shoot sharptails too. So I think it'd be a cool trip. That's my.
Yeah, I got a buddy that lives up north there, and he goes out and he gets into them once in a while.
Mm. Yeah, I knew many families that my sons grew up with from Baudette and Roseau, but they live down here in the Twin Cities. They're in Minnesota every year. We have MEA weekend, which is a teachers' convention weekend, mm-hmm. mid-October. They went sharptail hunting in northwestern Minnesota. That was their family's event. You know, for me, it was always pheasant hunting growing up, but for them, it's sharptails in northwestern Minnesota. So anyway, a little idea planter, if somebody's looking for a multi-species upland bird trip that happens to include prairie grouse.
Sounds like a good story for the super issue.
All right, Ryan Sparks, you get the final word to close us out. Where are you going?
Well, I mentioned that earlier that my cousins have a ranch in South Dakota. I'm going there. I mean, it's just there's the tradition of our family's been going there every year at least once for a long time. When they've had rain and it's green, you know, sometimes in the morning there'll be a low-lying fog. I took my wife there, and she just got back from a trip to Scotland, and she said it looks like the Scottish Highlands, like the moors there. Mm-hmm. It's just beautiful, and my family's there, and the bird numbers are pretty good too, so generally. So yeah, I'm going to South Dakota.
You know, I'm not disappointed with you, but I was thinking about the presentation we just listened to and the largest intact grasslands on the planet.
Yep.
is the Nebraska Sandhills.
Yep.
That's pretty special. As a Nebraskan, to know that the largest intact grassland still left.
There's a lot of sandhills in my future. Don't worry.
So it makes me think you're throwing people off the trail just a little bit.
Yeah. I heard Wisconsin's really nice, too. Yeah.
All right, fellas. That was a lot of fun.
It was.
Yeah, thank you very much. Clyde Vetter, the national treasure, Tom Carpenter.
The local yokel.
The regional gem. I should have prefaced the prairie grouse guru now, Clyde Vetter.
Well, I thought we graduated, didn't we, Tom?
Yeah, we, yep.
The prairie grouse guru, Tom Carpenter.
Gurus, yeah, guru pair.
And then the junkies.
The runner.
Ryan Sparks.
The runners up.
Yeah. And then finishing in last place, that's me. Bob St. Pierre, thanking you for listening and reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise, and maybe it'll be a prairie bird coming up here right now in the month of September. Get out there and chase him. Thanks for listening.